Now we'd like to welcome Lisa Peterson, our guest speaker for this morning.
Thank you. I've practiced, I've rewritten this probably 100 times, and as I go through this, I'm probably going to do it another 20 times. So what I'm saying is I have an outline here. So anyhow, good morning, happy Sunday to you. My name is Lisa Peterson, and I'm one of the co-chairs for the Orange County Poor People's Campaign. And this morning, there's another co-chair here from the Orange County Poor People's Campaign, Jan Meslin, who I just want to quick give a shout out to and thank her for coming. And so anyhow, with that being said, what I'm going to go over today is just give you a brief history of the Poor People's Campaign, how it was revived, what my story is, what we're doing here in Orange County, as well as nationwide as a movement. So anyhow, the history, as we know about the civil rights movement, that it had made some great progress, I would say, and here in the United States for people of color. However, that wasn't enough to be able to sustain and move the movement forward, to move people forward. Because as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had seen when he was up in Chicago and then came out to Watts during the riots, was that there was a deeper problem in our communities, and that was poverty. So on December 4th of 67, Dr. King, as well as the Southern Christian Leadership, which also known as SCLC, had announced that they were going to go and start the Poor People's Campaign, and that in spring of 68, that their launch was going to be in Washington, D.C., where they were going to resurrect a city. They were going to live there, and they weren't going to leave D.C. until our government officials started making changes to policies and recognizing that people needed better pay. They needed jobs, better housing, and education. Kind of sounds like what we're going through right now, doesn't it? Right? Yeah. So anyhow, there were three pillars in the campaign at that time, and it was poverty, systemic racism, and militarism, because a lot of our money that we pay into our federal taxes goes to support our military. And fast forward by 4 months to that date, on April 4th of 68, Dr. King was assassinated, and a lot of people were devastated by the news because he was such a fabulous leader and very sincere, and it was a great loss. And so the leaders at SCLC weren't quite sure what to do, so they reached out to Loretta Scott King, and they asked her, they said, you know, Miss King, you know, what do we do? And she said, you know, the tragedy, of my husband being killed was horrible. But what's even worse is the people who live in poverty and die in poverty day to day is even much worse, and that this campaign must go forward. And so they did. They set out around Mother's Day, went to D.C., people caravaned all across the U.S., and set up, and they visited. But during those 6 weeks that they occupied D.C., there were a lot of rain. There was also still heartbroken, and leadership was kind of, it wasn't the best because they weren't all quite on board with King's vision, especially when he denounced the war in Vietnam. And so by July of 68, the campaign pretty much came to a standstill. So we want to fast forward to like over four decades later, and there was a Dr. Reverend William Barbara, who started Moral Mondays in North Carolina, where each Monday they would go to the state capitol and protest. Also, Reverend Barber, was also the president of NAACP. And on this one particular Monday, him and other protesters, when they were at the state capitol protesting that we have the right to health care, they were arrested. But not only were they arrested, but they were also banned from their capitol. And so as we know that we have the right to assemble at our capital and to speak with our government officials. So Dr. Barber, as well as other his lawyers got together, they challenged the system and they won. And so he was absolutely outraged by the fact that they would even try to ban him from going there and speaking his piece. So he stepped down as president of NAACP, and he revived the Poor People's Campaign. But it wasn't just a revival of the campaign. It was a moral revival. Because here in the United States, a lot of regression is happening in our morals and our values and reaching out and giving each other a hand. And this is absolutely outrageous, and he was infuriated. So, along with other people. So, now, that's the revival of the campaign. He revived it. There's a co-chair, Dr. Reverend Liz Theo Harris, and together they started up the nationwide campaign, as well as help from many others, of course. It takes a village to go ahead and create a movement. So the reason why I got involved with the Poor People's Campaign is that I've actually been waiting quite some time for this campaign to come back around again, probably 20 years to be exact. I was born into poverty and into a violent household. I know what it's like to be hungry. I know what it's like to witness violence firsthand and to be discriminated against for being poor. Eventually, my mother was able to get rid of my father, get him out of the household. And so she worked three jobs, one as a newspaper carrier, as a bartender, so that way she could pay the babysitter to watch me at nighttime as she went to work at the Violent Development Center, where she was a certified nursing assistant, and she cared for the mental and physically handicapped. Eventually, she met someone who was rather successful and really liked her a lot and thought I was pretty cool, too. And so instead of giving her a handout, he gave her a hand up. She was able to quit two of her jobs, and she went back to school. She got her LPN, and she also got her RN, which is really cool. And during that time, we were able to move out of the trailer park and into a house, into a more of a middle-class neighborhood. And you would think things would change and get better, but it hadn't. Not for me, at least, anyhow. I still had not really spent any time with my mom because she was working 6-7 days a week at her one job. The community that I had at the trailer park, the support, because you always knew who to go to for what in your community, and you also know who to stay away from. Well, living in suburbia in a house, that was all taken away from me, and everyone was just inside their homes. And not really, there wasn't any support, and I became more isolated. This in turn affected my schooling and my education and my ability to socially adapt and make friendships. By the time I hit my senior year of high school, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with my life. I wasn't even sure I wanted to have a life because I was pretty hopeless, you know, growing up. And so I decided that, you know, I could either go work in a factory, I could get married and have kids. I sure wasn't ready to go off to college because I haven't developed quite the maturity for that yet. And so I decided that the military was the best thing for me because my ex-high school sweetheart had gone to the military to become a Green Beret. So while I served my time, after a few months being in the Army, I was out one morning doing a cadence. You know, we're marching, doing our cadence. And our cadence was, it was an eye-awakener for me. It was like someone came in and hit me back in the head. And the words to this was, the grass is green, green, green. Shoot to kill, kill, kill. The grass is now full of blood. It's red, red, red. And I was like, holy cow, Batman. I just went from a bad situation into what personally I call my hell. And luckily, it was the 1992s. We weren't in any war. The military was cutting back its budget. I went to my drill sergeants and my captain, and I told them exactly what I thought and felt, and that I'd made an error, and that I wished to leave. So I was discharged dishonorably, happily to do so. I even asked, how can I pay back the funds that were given to me, you know, because I felt so bad that I did not stick out my obligation. So, long story short, I got to come back home, but my high school sweetheart, who had been in a Green Beret, was not so lucky. He stayed in the military, but when he came back home, he came back in a body bag because he was sent off to Somalia and was one of the individuals that were killed there during that situation. So, fast forward, I ended up getting a factory job, married someone who I shouldn't had. Sometimes didn't quite live paycheck to paycheck. Luckily, Bank of America or Wells Fargo, one of the two, did paycheck advances. So I was able to sometimes be able to do that so that way I could put gas in my car so that way I can get to one of my two jobs and then go to school. And so this campaign is very near and dear to my heart because I know what it's like to suffer. I know what it's like to be hopeless, to not know which direction to go in. And since I was the age of 4, one of my things, places in my heart was to help people who are also disadvantaged. Because I believe that by us working together, that we would be able to stand strong and have that hope that we so needed to be able to get through day to day. So that's it. That's it in a nutshell. There's a lot more details, of course, but I only have, like I'm told, 25 minutes, and I still have to tell you about what we're doing here in Orange County, as well as nationwide, as well as there's going to be four people coming up here to share their lovely story about the Poor People's Campaign, because they have a part in it as well in moving us forward. So here in Orange County, on December 4th of 2017, that marked the 50-year announcement that Dr. King and SCLC had made about the Poor People's Campaign. So there was a nationwide kickoff all across cities and towns across the U.S., and we launched the Poor People's Campaign right here in Orange County. We had less than 9 days to prepare, but our goal, our mission is that there's poverty, there's racial discrimination, and there's homeless veterans living out in the street. We have our problems too, whether if we see it or not. And to this date, we meet on a monthly basis. We strategize on what we're going to do. We've created a website. We have a Facebook page where we interact with one another, sharing stories and information and connecting others. We have T-shirts that are available online with no overhead cost to us. And the proceeds, part of them goes to a homeless community nonprofit, as well as we get like about a dollar, so that way we're able to use that money for marketing materials and for tabling at different events. And let's see here. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to do a quick plug. This Wednesday, July 18th, across from the Santa Ana Airport at IHOP, we have our meeting. It's social times from 6 to 6:30, and then at 6:30, our meeting begins. So I really hope that you, if you can, to come out and join us, because we're going to talk about phase two of the Poor People's Campaign. Now you're wondering, whoa, what happened to phase one? Well, we just completed phase one. And phase one was a nationwide Poor People's Campaign second one. But this one involved 40 days of nonviolent direct action, moral fusion direct action. So over people in over 30 states in the United States have participated as moral witnesses and moral supporters. And at this time, before I go further into that, I'm going to go ahead and call some individuals up. And as they're making their way up here, I'll finish telling you about the 40 days, and then I'll have each person go ahead and have them briefly share their story. So at this time, I'd like to ask for Leslie Mahaffey, Sophia Ventura Cruz, Jan Meslin, and Jim Cruz to come forward. So that way you can share your story. Come on up here, folks, my friends. So the 40 days involved, on Mondays, we met at our state capitol. Here in Sacramento, we caravaned and we met with hundreds of other people. We participated in nonviolent civil disobedience. Each Monday was a different act of nonviolent civil disobedience. I participated in nonviolence twice, as well as I was a moral supporter once. And the people that you see standing up here alongside of me also participated as well. And so I like for them to go ahead at this time, one at a time, to share their story.
Back in May, I traveled with a diverse group of passionate activists to the first Poor People's Campaign action at the state capitol. I'd been to Sacramento for legislative lobby days before, but the idea of blocking traffic or disrupting a legislative session was a really different prospect for me. As you might imagine, that's not something I found myself doing. So I wasn't quite ready on that first opportunity to take that step. I really had to think about, what was I doing? Why was I doing it? But I was really drawn to the big goals of the Poor People's Campaign, with its big umbrella of issues, and also its focus on nonviolent direct action. And I had received some training on what that was about and how to conduct myself in the event of, you know, being in a situation where you had direct opposition to what you were doing. And it was really past time for me to step out of my bubble, you know, my suburban white bubble that I live in. We did block traffic, and it was a little scary, but it was really less so because of the friendly faces that were around me. The group that I was surrounded by, and then Jim Cruz as my ever-present support person that helped me feel more comfortable. As it worked out, none of our group was arrested on that day. 4 weeks later, though, dozens of California Poor People's Campaign activists had been jailed overnight. I think, Lisa, you have the number, but anyway, and Jan was one of those people that actually spent a night in detention. I felt just deep respect for the people that had made that sacrifice, because I think it had dawned on me what that meant, the discomfort and the, you know, rearranging your life and the aftermath of being detained and how that was all going to work out legally. So in June, I had another opportunity to go up there to Sacramento. And this time I knew that I would put myself in a situation to be detained. And the difference was the people that I knew that would be with me. And so I wouldn't go fearlessly into it. I was taking my fears with me, knowing that I had a cohort around. And so on that day in June, after communicating our demands first to the legislators, about 100 of us or so peacefully but loudly interrupted the California Senate during their afternoon legislative session. And our voices rang out in song, and the business as usual stopped for a moment. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jan, member of Orange Coast UU Church over in Costa Mesa. I love the Poor People's Campaign because of its moral focus, the fusion of issues, and the direct action, which is key to its success. I was excited when it kicked off a few months ago, especially because the UU Association president, Susan Frederick Gray, was front and center with Reverend Barber. UUs are in this movement all over the country. At General Assembly last month in Kansas City, Susan spoke of the urgency of this moment, that we as people of faith must respond because we are in the moral crisis right now. She said it is our duty to all of us to be involved in our own ways. She said that in order to make change, we must be willing to step outside our comfort zones. To me, going to a march is not stepping outside my comfort zone. I've been doing it for years, but I understand it is for many people, and I honor that. I also honor people who write letters, make phone calls, give money to human rights organizations, make cookies for events, et cetera, et cetera. I'm retired, so I don't have to worry about losing my job if I get arrested. And so it was an easy decision for me to risk arrest. And we shut down the state assembly. I believe it was the Senate that you guys helped us shut down, which was against the law. You know, we wouldn't leave. And I ended up getting 5 misdemeanor tickets. There were 20 of us that one day. And it was not fun being in jail overnight. Lights bright all night, treated as if I was less than by the Sacramento sheriffs, going without food for 12 hours, lying on a dirty cement floor just to get some rest, witnessing women in the cell with me who were really in dire straits, who don't have the same choices I have. I really enjoyed getting to know Sophia and Jim better. No, they weren't in jail with me, but we went to Sacramento together. I already knew Leslie from years of activism together, as you use, and so I was happy to be there with her when she was seeking to get arrested that day. And I love Lisa's passion and commitment to justice for all. I do plan to risk arrest again. I just don't know when or how many times until I see some justice. What will you do to step outside your comfort zones and make change? And let me just remind you that slavery was legal. Rosa Parks sitting in the front of the bus was illegal. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sophia. I'm going to be looking at Lisa for a little hint on when to stop talking, given that there's two cruises up here. We know we can talk for a little while. I'd first like to thank Lisa and also this whole congregation, because I definitely would not be standing here today if it wasn't for the social justice compass that this church has instilled in me, and I will be forever grateful for that. I first heard about the Poor People's Campaign sitting at my school in New York City. I was doing homework for my mass incarceration class, and I emailed Debbie a couple weeks before asking her if she recommended anything I should get involved with during the summer. And she told me to reach out to Lisa, which I did, and Lisa emailed me back within like 2 minutes, which I was just amazed by. I was like, oh my gosh. Like, so I heard about the Poor People's Campaign, and I was incredibly amazed that it was so centered in Orange County, specifically because I learned so much at my school. As many of you know, I'm a peace and justice major, so I'm constantly, you know, inundated with theory and stuff about those topics, but I've always wanted to take that and apply it in a practical sense, and not only just in an international or national way, but also just in a local way. So it was amazing for me to be able to take classes about systematic racism, take classes about environmental degradation and indigenous issues, and be able to apply that in my own community. So I went up to Sacramento at the very end of May. I went by myself, which was also kind of, that was me getting out of my comfort zone. My dad did not go with me, so it was good for me to be able to not have that, you know, safety net immediately next to me, so I had to try a little harder to reach out. But I really appreciated the event, and it was amazing for me as a young person to be surrounded by so many activists who have been involved for so many years. And to see them so dedicated to social justice as well, and see the campaign so dedicated to intersectionality, which is like something that is incredibly important to me, and see people rallying behind militarism, which is something that I'm usually not I don't spend a lot of time around veterans, so that was incredibly important for me, and I just feel immensely honored to be here today and share a little bit, and thank you again for always inspiring me.
The past is not dead, Faulkner said. It is not even past. I'm going to save my personal comments. I'll be happy to converse about them in the social hall, or even more so in the discussion group that we invite all of you to, that's been organized by the Social Action Committee, that you should be remain so grateful for having such an active presence here in this community. I cite to Faulkner in order to invoke the memory of the civil rights leaders who inspired the troubled birth of Poor People's Campaign in the very, very complex 1960s. Marion Wright Edelman, a leading woman civil rights activist, escorted the very complex but ultimately soulful Robert F. Kennedy into Appalachia and into the Delta of Mississippi, where Faulkner wrote from. By all accounts, the very complex Robert F. Kennedy was very moved and actually wept at the sight of the poverty that he didn't just read about in a briefing paper, but that he saw, touched, and heard. He took it back to the Senate, and he asked for more help to be delivered to Mississippi. And when it wasn't, he went back to Marion Wright Edelman and asked her to inspire Martin to march on Washington. I invoke the memory of these murdered victims who inspired Poor People's Campaign, and I remind you, there are very sober, very experienced very scholarly people today who are warning us in detail how democracies die, how the rule of law is limited, and how there is the opportunity to participate. It may come, as was evidenced by everyone this morning, it may come that we must learn the tactics of morally inspired, direct action, nonviolent civil disobedience. It may come to that. And I ask you to remember these important leaders who inspired the tactics and the moral vision that is being articulated this morning by Lisa and the Poor People's Campaign. Thank you.
So just to sum up everything and conclude, I hope that you join us for further discussion, or my contact information will be out there on the social justice table, so we can always continue having a conversation offline. So poverty is intergenerational, and sometimes well-off people end up becoming poor due to unfortunate situations, whether if it's becoming sick in a car accident, losing a job, or having your investments go south. And so it's 2018, and we're still dealing with the same issues that have been going on for decades and decades, and it's time that we stop passing off these issues to future generations, and to take a stand now, and to be known in this time period that we were the ones that cared, that we stood up, and that we spoke out, and that we did something. And so with that being said, when things are broken, we have the choice to put back the pieces how we want to. And I ask that you please help us to open the minds and hearts of those who are still asleep in our communities. So that way, through the people power, not only will we work smart and not hard, but in solidarity, we will overcome injustice.